We all know about the bloody end of World War II, but how did the world emerge from the wreckage? Ian Baruma joins us to talk about his remarkable new history, Year Zero.
It's one of those awful things that people in the West perhaps didn't know very much about, but it's one of the many atrocities committed by the Germans.
What's wrong with privatizing America's public school system? Diane Ravitch will have a lot to say about that when we discuss her new book, Reign of Error.
90% of our kids go to public schools. We cannot privatize them. We cannot hand them over to entrepreneurs.
Nixon and Kissinger remain associated in many minds with conflict in Vietnam, Chile, and Cambodia. But what was their role in the forgotten tragedy of Bangladesh? Gary Bass will talk about his new book, The Blood Telegram.
So we don't know exactly the number, but we know that the refugee flow is colossally large. One of the worst atrocities of the 20th century.
Julie Bosman joins us with notes from the field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. Finally this week, something new. You can listen to an exclusive preview of Dave Eggers' forthcoming novel, The Circle, which will be on our website this Saturday. You can also find it on iTunes, where you download this podcast. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Ian Baruma joins us. He is the author of Year Zero, A History of 1945, the most recent of his many books. Ian, thank you so much for coming in.
Very nice to be with you.
So this is a look at 1945. It's a global history and also a personal history. Can you tell us about the personal history and did that lead you to look at this larger picture?
Yes, because I was always very interested in my father's experiences, and he was forced to work in Berlin. He was Dutch and lived through the Battle of Berlin and so on and so forth. And I always asked him questions. A lot of children don't really want to hear their parents' war stories and they find it boring, but I never did. I was fascinated by that and by his generation and how they came out of the war and tried to put the world together again. And so,
what happened with your father?
Well, he was a student in the beginning of the war, a law student in Holland. And to be a law student, you joined the fraternity. And joining the fraternity meant all kinds of hazing rituals and so on. And the Germans, who occupied Holland since 1940, had banned these fraternities because they were afraid they would be sources of resistance.
Wanted to do all the hazing.
They wanted to do the hazing. So the hazing went on anyway, but it was underground. When my father came back from Berlin and had experienced the bombings and, you know, he was almost killed by a Soviet soldier and so on, he got back and then he found that he had to do the hazing ritual all over again because it had been done clandestinely during the war. And this baffled me. I thought how extraordinary that men experienced even worse things than my father had been in concentration camps, that these boys had to sort of do this ridiculous stuff and be bullied again to join a fraternity. Then I realized it was really because they were so eager to regain the life as it had been before the war,
right,
and the kind of normality, that this to them was normality. And that's really how the whole book starts, with the notion that, of course, things can never really go back after a catastrophe like a world war, and the world is always going to be different.
I mean, in the American experience, we think of 1945 as this, you know, jubilant year of liberation and VA Day and VJ Day. And, well, yes, we all know that sort of, you know, England had a hard time getting back on its feet, but we don't really think of it as a terrible period because here, of course, we had our post-war boom. But you really talk about some of the, not just the terrible economic devastation, but then some really terrible things that happened in these countries.
Well, there are two things that happen almost after every war, and we see it in Iraq, we see it anywhere really where there's a bad war, which is the thirst for revenge. People who have been under the cosh, who've been oppressed, suppressed, so on, resistance fighters and so on, want to take their revenge on oppressive regimes and their collaborators. Linked to that is the question of legitimacy. If you put a country together again after having been under oppression or occupation. Who has the legitimacy to rule? And the people who were in the resistance, of course, feel that they do and want to purge the old guard. And how to solve that problem is a problem after every war, and in recent wars, naively or willfully, I think people hadn't anticipated it.
You talk not only about Europe, but it's also a global look, and you write about Japan. And it sounds like in that instance, Americans came in and they didn't really know who the legitimate power was. And talk about that a little bit and what happened with war criminals there.
Well, that's right. They didn't really know. And they knew very little about the country. And what is astonishing is that Douglas MacArthur, who was the kind of shogun in Japan in the occupation period, was, of course, a right-wing Republican who had a very messianic idea of his own role and wanted to sort of Christianize the Japanese and so on, that the people who worked for him in the beginning of the occupation were mostly democratic New Dealers. And their view was that it doesn't matter what the culture or the tradition or the history is. If you introduce democratic change and have elections and free trade unions and so on, things will be okay, rather, you know, the sort of rhetoric you get from neoconservatives today. I mean, the origin of that is actually left-wing rather than right-wing. And the people who are against that, who said, no, you need the emperor and these people are not used to democracy, you need a strong hand, and so, were right-wingers and Republicans. And in the beginning, the New Dealers prevailed. And the Japanese, most Japanese, were more than happy to cooperate with that because they were very sick of war and militarism and so relieved that the American occupation was much less malign than the Japanese occupation of Asian countries had been.
What comes across is that obviously there was this urge for revenge and it was taken out in many cases, but also just unintended consequences that people were trying to do the right thing, that Americans overfed concentration camp survivors and then people as a consequence.
Well, they didn't know what to do with famine because it was a phenomenon that Western troops hadn't really encountered except in India. Because there was a terrible famine during the war in Bengal, which millions of people lost their lives. But they didn't really know what to do when they saw people in concentration camps who had been starved. And starving people, of course, can't eat military rations with spam and that kind of thing. They would get very sick and often die. And so to find a way to nurse people back to some semblance of health after they'd been systematically deprived of proper food and drink was a problem they hadn't encountered, and so mistakes were made.
And not only with concentration camp survivors, but also with POWs. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with POWs from the Soviet Union? And
POWs, the Russian or the Soviet POWs in German captivity, many of them didn't survive because they were deliberately starved. They were often put in open air camps that they couldn't escape with no sanitary provisions whatsoever and simply starved to death. It's one of those awful things that people in the West perhaps didn't know very much about, but it's one of the many atrocities committed by the Germans.
And then those who were returned, the POWs returned.
Well, the thing is that people from the Soviet Union who, for whatever reason, as POWs or as foreign workers or as slaves or as captured troops, found themselves in Western hands. They were, because of that, already distrusted. They'd left the Soviet Union. They'd been in the outside world. And as such, were often punished when they came back. And people who'd fought on the other side, on the German side, and that did happen with a lot of Soviet troops, sometimes because they had no choice. They were either in these starvation camps and were then given the option, okay, you starve to death or you fight for the German army. Now, many of those people ended up in the German army. Many of them fought in Normandy during D-Day, for example. They were happy to be captured by the Allied troops. To that was a kind, them, that was a kind of liberation, but they were treated by Stalin as collaborators. The Allies knew that if they sent these POWs back to the Soviet Union, they'd be killed. And even though they knew it, they did it. because they didn't want to upset Stalin. They didn't want them to as refugees in their own countries. And it's one of the very nasty things that happened after the war.
I mean, this is a much darker and more nuanced in general view of liberation in 1945 and the end of the good war that most Americans are familiar with. I mean, is there any truth to that whole heroic narrative, or is this...
Well, there are two things. One is there's no doubt the Nazis and the Japanese had to be defeated. So in that sense, it was a good war. It's also true that out of terrible destruction, you get a creation as well. And it was a time of great idealism, of people feeling that, you know, now is the chance to build a better world, a more equal world. The United Nations was founded. Social democracy began. And one of the sources I used for this book was a U.S. Army magazine written by U.S. Army personnel for soldiers and sailors called Yank. And the politics of Yank in 1945 are well to the left of the Democratic Party today. I mean, reads like The Nation.
Right. As a woman, obviously, I couldn't help but note the number of rapes that occurred. That this really, I don't think, has been discussed when you think about how many women were left in these countries and rapes by Americans.
I don't think the Americans were particularly guilty of it. It's the Soviets were. And that was a deliberate revenge on the Germans. And it must be also be said that however horribly the Soviet Red Army behaved in Germany, it was still not nearly as bad as what the Germans did in the Soviet Union. They were actually encouraged by their officers to do their worst. And there was there were various reasons for this. One was revenge. The other one was that even in bombed out, destitute Germany in 1945, what the Soviet troops saw in Germany to them still represented an unbelievably rich country.
Yes.
And so there was a kind of class, element of class revenge in that too. How dare these people who've mistreated us so badly live in these circumstances, live so well, and we're going to smash everything we see.
Things certainly didn't get better from there for them.
No.
Thank you so much. Ian Baruma's new book is Year Zero, A History of 1945. Ian, thank you so much for coming in.
It was a pleasure to be here.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Steelheart by bestselling author Brandon Sanderson. That's Steelheart, the first in Sanderson's new series, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So you wrote about a book that came out recently, but the author was only recently identified.
Yes, this is a literary mystery that dates back to the 1850s, and it started with a manuscript that was discovered in an attic in New Jersey several decades ago. And that book was published under the title A Bondwoman's Narrative.
We knew that this was a book by a woman, by a female slave.
They realized that this was the first book that was written by a black woman and definitely the first book that was written by a female slave.
And it was published before they knew who exactly she was, right? Because this is a pseudonym.
Yes. So in 2002, the book was published by Warner Books, now Grand Central Publishing, and it instantly became a bestseller. It was praised for its dramatic depiction of Southern life in the 1850s. And it was a novel that was written, you know, through the eyes of a very observant and obviously literate house servant. But no one knew who exactly the author was. Henry Louis Gates Jr., the African-American scholar, had figured out that it was probably written by a slave on the John Hill Wheeler estate in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. But no one knew the name of this woman or what her personal story was.
So who figured this out?
So over the last 10 years, a professor of English in South Carolina, a man named Greg Hekimovich, who's the chairman of the English department at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina, has embarked on a little detective hunt of his own. And he has figured out through interviewing people in North Carolina, people who were members of the Wheeler family and dug up archives, dug up papers, letters, journals, almanacs, and handed them over to this professor, he figured out the name of the woman and more about the path that she took in writing the book and how she eventually escaped to freedom in the North.
And what got him interested in this story? And was this his area of expertise, or was this kind of a side project that he took on?
It was not his area of expertise. He was or is a Victorian scholar, so this wasn't really what he knew about. He said that he had done some work in African-American literature when he was a grad student, but didn't really know much about it. I think he became interested in it partly just because it was in his backyard.
So what's the story with the book? Is it going to be republished under her real name, or are they reissuing it?
It's going to be reissued by Grand Central Publishing. They're going to publish a new introduction by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Greg Hekimovich, who are writing that introduction right now, and it'll be re-released early next year.
All right. Well, a new, very old book coming out soon then. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks.
Diane Ravitch is here to talk about her new book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
So this is, in a way, a follow-up to your previous book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System.
Right.
What did you do in that book, and what did you want to continue or change or write about in this book that you didn't cover in there?
After I wrote that book, I thought that I had said everything I had to say on the subject, but the landscape kept changing. And the purpose of this book was to pick up where Death and Life left off, showing how much things had changed, because the trends I was describing at that point were to many people a shock, and that they've only gotten worse in the ensuing 3 years. And then I wanted to make my list of solutions, which I had been talking about: reduce class size, the importance of the arts, the importance of a full balanced curriculum, the importance of addressing both school improvement and poverty. And one of the gripes of the critics was that, oh, all you do is talk about poverty, you don't talk about fixing schools. Well, that's not true. They say that you can end poverty by fixing schools, and that has never happened either here or in any other society. There's a lot in the book about the effects of poverty and how it handicaps kids, and it's the single best predictor of test scores is family income.
When you look at these problems, I mean, these problems are not new, and it seems like, you know, education trends, you know, come and they go and they circle back, but over and over again you do come back to these fundamental problems that, you know, maybe aren't sexy and maybe aren't new but are still there and are unaddressed.
Some of these problems existed in the early 20th century, probably all of them, because we had this immense wave of immigrants, particularly into the big cities, and they were people like, you know, my family and families of lots of other people coming in not speaking English, dirt poor. And the cities developed a different approach. Instead of just saying, we're going to teach you the three R's, we're going to have no excuses, you're going to walk in a straight line, they said, we're going to develop medical and social services, we're going to do things to help kids who have problems. And so today, as I go to different cities and I see all these services being cut, and we can't afford them, we can't afford the arts, we can't afford medical services, we can't afford guidance counselors. I was just in Philadelphia and before that in Pittsburgh, and my heart was breaking to think that we can't, in the 21st century, afford what we did 100 years ago for the children of immigrants. So yes, there are recurring problems, but right now the people who call themselves reformers, and I actually hate that term, but it's the only one that they keep calling themselves reformers. They say we don't have to worry about fixing poverty because we'll fix poverty,
right,
with just changing schools.
I mean, there was a profile recently of Joel Klein in the New York Times Magazine, and it seems that, you know, when they're not privatizing schools, the solution now is to sort of throw technology in, because you can have a corporation who's eager to provide that, and it might not necessarily cost as much money as, say, solving poverty. But when he was asked about alternatives, Klein didn't seem to, you know, he didn't seem to deny that there were problems with things like teachers' pay and the prestige of the teaching profession, and that it really, in many ways, does come down to that. But he nonetheless sort of insisted that this new solution, this new technology, might somehow improve things in the face of that.
Well, I'm certainly not an enemy or critic of technology. I've seen it used by creative teachers, and I've been to many technology conferences. I've been blown away by what teachers are doing to integrate technology into their classrooms. But I think that the holy grail in the business world is to come up with the technology that will replace teachers. The holy grail, and I heard this described by when I used to be, as you know, in right-wing think tanks. And in one of the right-wing think tanks, a colleague was describing the object is to have a teacher somewhere in a barn in Kansas monitoring hundreds of screens. And think of the savings. There wouldn't be a need for all those teachers, because just a few people working 24/7 in three shifts in that barn in Kansas could take the place of what might be hundreds of teachers. So huge cost savings, and that is the holy grail. I'm afraid that in many places that's the thinking, and I think it's very bad thinking. As a parent, as a grandparent, I want my children to have human teachers. I want them to understand how to use technology, but I don't want their teachers replaced by them.
You talked earlier about the privatization of schools, which is obviously a big part of your book. In 1955, when Milton Friedman proposed the whole voucher system, I mean, the idea of, you know, government schools as this terrible thing and privatizing education was really a fringe concept. As a historian of education, how do you explain the mainstreaming of that idea?
Well, the most peculiar thing of phenomenon, I'd say, of the past at least decade is the bipartisan consensus that has ended with Milton Friedman's ideas in the ascendancy. There are now something like 17 or 18 states that have some form of a voucher approach in which money can be used to go to religious schools. What's bizarre about it is not only have vouchers never worked anywhere, they failed spectacularly in Milwaukee, which has had vouchers since 1990 and seen no improvement either in the public schools or in the voucher schools. All of them get very low scores. And there are three sectors in Milwaukee: charters, vouchers, and a shrinking public sector. And Milwaukee, when it competes on the national assessment, which is the federal test, is one of the lowest performing cities in the country. But how did this come about? There has been a lot of money invested by foundations like the Walton Family Foundation, which is the Walmart company. They have invested huge amounts of money in promoting public policy think tanks in every state, almost every state. There's a lot of money if you're a supporter of vouchers. There's a lot of money to support your advocacy for vouchers. That has been persistent. The country in the last 30 years has become, since the Reagan administration report called The Nation at Risk, obsessed with the idea that we're failing and we're falling behind.
No child left behind.
And, yeah, right, Nation at Risk then leads from 1983 to 2002. We then get No Child Left Behind, and an obsession with data. And what I start the book doing is to say that every part of this narrative is wrong, because I began looking at the data and scrutinizing it and discovered our schools are not failing. American education is actually a great success story. And where there is low performance is where there is segregation and high poverty. We have incredible numbers of kids with language problems, disabilities, foreign-born students. And despite all this, the test scores today are at their highest point in history on the national federal exams. I've come to believe that what we now call school reform, and again with hesitation using calling it reform because I think it's actually school destruction, we have people now obsessed with opening charter schools, even though charter schools on average don't get any better, different results from public schools. We're now closing public schools in cities across the country. Philadelphia's on the brink of bankruptcy because the state won't live up to its responsibilities to fund the district. Detroit is closing down. Schools are closing down in urban districts across the country. Some districts have actually been turned over to for-profit corporations in the state of Michigan. And with so many very far-right governors, the privatization trend has accelerated. Bobby Jindal wants to privatize public education. The Tea Party governor of North Carolina wants to privatize public education. It's just an incredible trend, particularly out there on the far fringes of the right. I don't see Arne Duncan, the Obama right. administration, going on the air and saying, this is ridiculous. We cannot lose our public schools. This 90% of our kids go to public schools. We cannot privatize them. We cannot hand them over to entrepreneurs. And if anything, he has been encouraging and supportive of these very terrible trends in education.
I mean, one of the ironies is that here we are privatizing schools because the idea is that private schools somehow do it better. And yet, when you look at what the private schools are doing, they're often much more progressive than the public schools. They're not testing at all. Many of them don't have this endless focus on results and on these measures.
That's true. Finland doesn't test at all until kids finish school when they apply to higher education. We now have an obsession with testing. It's making the testing industry, which is a very concentrated industry, very, very rich. It's doing terrible things to American kids. It's demoralizing teachers.
But even in American private schools, they're doing the kinds of things. If here we are trying to privatize public schools, the private schools are doing the kinds of things you're talking about, teaching to the whole child, having a social and emotional component, offering the arts and offering, you know, music education, moving away from testing.
Well, it makes me think sometimes that those people who don't like public education are ruining it on purpose, because parents will then withdraw their children and say, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to start a new school. I mean, new schools are being started all over the place to escape this reign of error with the testing obsession. So the point I want to say about the testing, though, is it doesn't help children. And just to give you an example, last spring we had the first Common Core test given in New York State. The results came in August. The kids didn't even have the same teacher, and then the teachers were not allowed to see the children's answers to the test, which meant the tests were totally useless. They had nothing to do with the diagnostic purpose of testing. It was only about ranking and rating and telling everybody who failed and who passed. So tests have become an instrument of torture, basically. They have absolutely no function in terms of helping children learn, because the teachers never find out what the kids need to know. We're certainly on the wrong track there.
You brought up the Common Core. So before we end, just curious to hear what your thoughts are on that curriculum.
I think that the Common Core was rushed into production way too quickly. I would talk to people over the past 4 years at the White House and people writing the Common Core and told them to field test it, find out what the flaws were, find out what works and what doesn't work. They refused to do it. And they're now paying the price. No big company in America would introduce a huge new product without field testing it somewhere. And yet they thought they could roll out national standards, use the clout of the federal government to force them down everyone's throat. And we're seeing now a tremendous backlash, largely from the Tea Party, but also from a lot of very liberal people who say this is a standardized, scripted curriculum, and it shows a distrust for teachers. I mean, the basic thing with Common Core, but also with testing in general, is that it's about we don't trust teachers. We don't, and the reason we're testing so much is we don't believe that teachers should be able to exercise any judgment. So the thrust of all this so-called reform is to destroy the teaching profession. It's a very damaging reform, and that's why and when I'm gone from this earth, I want that book to be there so that teachers take heart and so that parents understand that what we're doing, these policies are wrong and there is a better way, and we do know how to remediate them. We do know what better education looks like. The pushback we've seen in Seattle, where an entire staff at Garfield High School said, we will not give the test. And the superintendent threatened to cut their pay, and they stood firm and said, we will not give the test. And they didn't give the test, and they didn't get punished. I'm going to be meeting them, actually, when I get to Seattle in a few days. We've seen the parents of the state of Texas force this place, which was the birthplace of testing, to roll back a lot of the high-stakes testing in the state of Texas. And there it was the angry moms. They call them, they're known in Texas as moms against drunk testing. They have a more formal
name. So we've infuriated students, parents and teachers so far. At least there are certain signs of rebellion against these developments in education.
This is all done in the name of equity. And the fact is, this is not equitable at all. It's not helping poor kids. And now as the testing spreads and becomes nationwide and the stakes get higher, now the suburbs are engaged and you've got a lot of angry parents. So I think that all of this is going to come crashing down. I do believe it's a house of cards, and a couple of cards are missing at the bottom of the deck.
Well, a lot to think about. The book, again, is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch is the author. Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Bass is the author of a new book, The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. He joins us now. Gary, hi.
Hi, Pamela.
What is the Forgotten Genocide?
So this is a terrible series of massacres across what was then the eastern part of Pakistan that take place in 1971.
Now Bangladesh.
Exactly, present-day Bangladesh, that are carried out by the military government of Pakistan, cracking down on its Bengali population.
Well, how many people are we talking about?
This is something that's actually very contested. The official figure in Bangladesh is 3 million. There's a Pakistani report that says 26,000. Midway through the killing, the CIA was secretly estimating that it was 200,000. And then on top of that, you know, killing went on for many, many months after that. And there's also the mortality that you get in refugee camps when 10 million refugees flee into India. So we don't know exactly the number, but we know that the refugee flow is colossally large, and that the numbers are clearly one of the worst atrocities of the 20th century.
Now, we've forgotten about this in large part because this era was so dominated by headlines in Vietnam and Cambodia. Was there any awareness of what was going on at that time in America?
Yeah, there's definitely awareness, although exactly as you say, Vietnam in that time period dominates everything. But there's a lot of public awareness. Sydney Shanberg, a reporter for The New York Times, writes wonderful stuff about it.
He was the one portrayed in the film The Killing Fields.
In The Killing Fields. But there's also, there's the Concert for Bangladesh, which is sort of the precursor to other...
Right. And we knew about the famine.
Yeah. There's a lot of coverage about there are 10 million refugees who flood into India, which is one of the biggest refugee flows ever in human history. And that's the kind of thing that people pay attention to. 40 years later, people have forgotten about it. And there's also, I think, now there's all this declassified material that you can get your hands on to see what Nixon and Kissinger were actually doing.
Right. So we didn't know too much about the sort of political machinations behind our role in all of this.
Yeah. People know that the United States supports Pakistan, but to know the extent of what Nixon and Kissinger are really secretly saying in the White House, obviously there's no way that anybody at the time could have known that.
So for our listeners who have no idea what we're talking about, tell us the basic story. What happened with Kissinger and Nixon and their role in the creation of Bangladesh?
Yeah,
the genocide there.
Yeah, it's a story that I think obviously people don't really know. So there's a free and fair democratic election in Pakistan in 1970, and it's an extraordinary thing across the whole country. In West Pakistan, which is present-day just Pakistan, and East Pakistan, which is present-day Bangladesh. And the military government of Pakistan at the time doesn't like the results. So they launched this terrible military crackdown on the Bengalis. It's a Bengali nationalist party that wins these elections. And the White House stands firmly behind the Pakistani military government as it's doing this. So it's not like Bosnia or Rwanda where you say, well, there are terrible things happening in some part of the world and we should have done something about it. This is a case where the United States government is very heavily involved, but it's heavily involved in backing the killers.
The wrong side. Yeah. And there were strategic reasons why the U.S. was on the side of Pakistan, which had largely to do with India and Pakistan.
That's exactly right. There's a strategic part to it, which is, I think, that India in the Cold War is officially non-aligned, but in reality is tilting toward the Soviet Union. Pakistan is a U.S. ally, and Pakistan is also making itself very helpful at this period to Nixon and Kissinger, that Pakistan is carrying messages back and forth between the United States and China as Nixon and Kissinger are getting ready for their secret opening. So Pakistan's being useful in that way. But there's also a less strategic side, which is that, you know, the deeper you get into the White House tapes, the more you see the extent to which Nixon and Kissinger are just being propelled not so much by realpolitik, but by visceral emotion.
Now, there are obvious bad guys here, but also some very heroic figures, one of whom, Archer Blood, provides the title of your book.
Archer Blood is a career U.S. diplomat. He's a very kind of loyal, disciplined, patriotic foreign service officer, career foreign service, who in 1971, as this mass killing starts, he's the top U.S. diplomat, the consul general in East Pakistan, in present-day Bangladesh. And when the killing starts and he's sort of observing it and people he knows are being killed, people who he's friends with are being killed, and he and his consulate are sort of running around Dhaka and running around East Pakistan trying to find out as much information as they can about how the killing is unfolding, how U.S. weapons are being used to kill Bengalis. And after a while, he's stunned that there's no response from Washington. There's no statement of condemnation. There's no statement to, you know, to the Pakistani military saying, you guys, you know, you got to cut this out.
Right.
So Blood and his entire consulate write up a formal dissent cable drafted by a Foreign Service officer there named Scott Butcher. So they come up with this full cable saying that U.S. policy here is morally bankrupt, that this is a genocide, that we have to do something.
And when does he send this?
He sends it about 2 weeks in to the killing. So the killing starts on March 25th, and he sends this
1971,
and he sends this in on April 6th. So they transmit this.
And it goes to whom? Who gets this?
So technically, these cables are addressed to the Secretary of State, to William Rogers, but it goes to the whole State Department, not to the whole State Department, but to sort of the relevant parts of the State Department, where a bunch of Foreign Service officers there say, we agree with this and kind of sign on to it. And it goes to the Secretary of State and it goes to Henry Kissinger, who are absolutely furious, just sort of incandescent with rage.
But not that this is going on.
Yeah. It's not like we are so angry that all these people are getting massacred. It's no, we are so angry that our career diplomat on the ground is accurately reporting what's going on, which kind of messes us up. And we're furious that these guys, you know, would have the guts to speak out against it. So they actually shove Archer Blood out of his position as consul general.
And there's nothing he can really do at that point.
This guy is a real patriot who really believes in, you know, he believes in the United States as a force for good in the world. He believes in American diplomacy, so much so that even when the White House is trashing him, when privately Nixon and Kissinger calls him this maniac in Dhaka, while all that's going on, he still wants to work within the system. So it's something that I think is, very touching and very dramatic what this guy goes through.
You did a huge amount of research for the book, including a lot of travel and listening of tapes. Did you talk to Kissinger?
No, I really wanted to talk to Kissinger, both because, you know, I think obviously it's important in these things to get, you know, you want to represent all viewpoints as fairly as possible. And I do, you know, I want to give him the opportunity to comment on this. And also, obviously, because it would have been fun. But I asked him four times, and he ignored the first two requests. He said no, and then finally said no. So I interviewed a lot of his staffers. I interviewed the White House staff who were working on this. But no, I would have loved to.
Has he commented publicly on this incident? Has he written about it in his own books?
Yes, he's written on it in one of his memoirs, where he has a long chapter detailing it. And I try to use material from that. A lot of what's in that chapter is actually very deceptive and points the blame in other directions. So this book is in part a corrective to Kissinger's version.
Gary Bass, the author of The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. Gary, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Greg, you are calling in today.
I am, yeah. The Metro North situation is a little bit interesting right now. more an inconvenience than a tragedy. I'm stuck at home in Connecticut. It's not like I'm a war refugee worried about my life. And I do have a computer and I do have a telephone, so I'm ready to bring you bestseller news.
All righty. And we can segue cheesily into the top of the fiction hardcover list, right? With
Yeah, in fact, Nicholas Sparks has a new book out called The Longest Ride. It is not about Metro North. It's actually a book about two things. Nicholas Sparks, of course, writes these tearjerker love stories that get immediately made into big Hollywood movies. He wrote The Notebook. He wrote Message in a Bottle. The Longest Ride has two different love stories in it. One is the story of an old married couple, a widower who's just been in a train accident and is visited by kind of the spirit of his longtime beloved wife. And the second story, which gives the book its title, The Longest Ride, is about a bull rider, professional bull rider on the bull riding circuit who has become injured and is trying to work his way back into the tour, and a young student that he meets and falls in love with. That is new at the top of the list at number one. Then at number two on the hardcover fiction list, Nelson DeMille has a new book out called The Quest. At number three, J.D. Robb, who's really, of course, Nora Roberts, has a new book called Thankless in Death. Then jumping down to number six is the next new book on the list. It is Thomas Pynchon's new novel, Bleeding Edge.
Very different from those first five.
What's so interesting about this is Thomas Pynchon, of course, is not only famous as a recluse, he's also famously considered like a real kind of cult taste, a cult favorite. He appeals to a passionate but limited audience. But the fact is, I was looking at his history on the best list, and going back for the past 40 years, every novel that he's written since Gravity's Rainbow, which now this is the sixth consecutive novel that he's written since 1973, has made the bestseller list.
Does this mean that all readers are basically a very small but passionate group of people?
That's exactly it. His cult audience, it may in fact be a cult audience, but it doesn't take much to put you on the bestseller list. Then at number seven, there's another new title. There's really a lot of turnover on the hardcover fiction list this week. Number seven is new. It's by Catherine Coulter and J.T. Ellison. It's a book called The Final Cut. Then at number eight, Richard Castle has part of his Nikki Heat series. The next book in that is called Deadly Heat. And finally, the last new title on the print hardcover fiction list this week is at number 14. It's called Who Asked You, and that's the latest by Terry McMillan.
I was listening to Terry McMillan talk about the book, and I like the way that she pronounced the title, which is Who Asked You?
Not Who Asked You?
Right, which is how I kind of innocently thought about it. Who Asked You? That sounds much better.
Who Asked You? That's great. Not nearly as much turnover on the nonfiction hardcover list this week, but there are four new titles. Starting down lower at number seven, a book called Grain Brain. I think that the bestseller department, people who compile the list, maybe had a hard time deciding whether this one belonged on the nonfiction list or the how-to bestseller list, because it's another one of these anti-grain books.
Right. If you've done worrying about Wheat Belly, you can now fret about Grain Brain.
So Wheat Belly is over there on the miscellaneous how-to advice list as kind of a health and, advice book. Then new at number nine, the singer Linda Ronstadt has an autobiography out called Simple Dreams. Mostly music talk, also some book talk in there I mentioned in my column this week. And that's new on the list at number nine. Then at number 10, Diane Ravitch, whom you heard earlier on this podcast, her book Reign of Error is new on the list at number 10. And then new at number 12, the last new book on this week's hardcover nonfiction list is by Jeff Benedict and Armin Kataian. It is called The System, and it is about problems with NCAA college football.
The irony there being that the two books above it, The Smartest Kids in the World and Reign of Error, are about what's wrong with American schools. And one of the things they say is we're too obsessed with football.
Well, and apparently football has its own problems in the schools.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you, Pamela. I hope to see you again in the office one of these days.
Metro North willing.
All right.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.